1859, a year made famous, unfortunately not by the founding of this institution. That would have been good, but didn't. It wasn't what made it famous, nor the publication of this particular work by Tony Snyder in the United States. He couldn't find a publisher for his book, and as a result, he had to go to France. And of course, the year was made much more famous by the publication of The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. And it's partly because of that that this kind of an idea was so very unpopular. Can that be turned down or something? I'm getting feedback. There we go, that's a little better. He published a flood model, the idea that the continents were together before the flood. Africa and South America and North America and Europe were together before the flood. And during the flood, they rapidly separated as a process involved in the flood. Now, that particular idea is actually a forerunner of the modern concept of plate tectonics, but was in fact forgotten, and plate tectonics, when it came back into fashion, came back in moving continents very slowly. So there is some precedent for what I'm about to tell you about, which is a flood model for the geology of the flood recorded in Scripture. Back in 1986, several of us got together to begin putting such a model together, realizing that collectively we had some of the expertise necessary to do so. Ultimately, the group of six that are involved in this involve three geologists. Steve Austin has a PhD in sedimentary geology, Andrew Snelling, a PhD in hard rock geology, metamorphic and igneous geology, myself in paleontology, a physicist, John Baumgartner, who's studying the mantle of the Earth, Russ Humphreys, whose specialty involved the core of the Earth and the Earth's magnetic field, and then Larry Vardaman, an atmospheric physicist. So among us, we cover many of the fields of Earth science necessary to address the issue of how the flood, in fact, occurred. We ultimately published this particular paper in 1994. Now, I want to say, and it's important that you understand at this point, that this is just a model for how the flood might have worked. It is still work in progress. It probably will be work in progress for the next 200-300 years, if the Lord tarries. We start with a pre-flood Earth, very much like the present Earth, with a differentiated core, inner core, outer core, mantle, and crust. The inner core is thought to be iron-nickel, solid. The outer core, also iron-nickel, but liquid, probably about the viscosity of water, even though it is not made of water. It's got about that thickness or viscosity. The mantle, which is rock, makes up about half of the radius of the Earth and about 70% of the volume. It is a solid, but it behaves under certain pressures and temperatures as a plastic fashion, as we shall see. And then on the surface, a crust. Actually, the thickness indicated here is much greater than the actual thickness. The crust is only the scum on the surface of the Earth. It's extremely thin compared to the thickness of the Earth. Looking a little more closely at that crust, turns out there are two major types of crust sitting on the planet, floating in a sense on the mantle of the Earth. There is a thinner, denser crust underneath the oceans, made primarily of basalt. This crust is more dense than the crust underneath the continents. As a result, it sits lower, like if you have a piece of balsa wood and a piece of oak floating in water. The oak, denser, will in fact sit lower in the water than the balsa wood. Likewise, the continental crust sits higher in the mantle than does the ocean crust. And as a result, water, which seeks its lowest position with respect to the center of the Earth due to gravity, in fact goes in to cover the ocean crust, thus the oceans are sitting over the ocean crust. And the reason there are oceans today is because the ocean crust is denser than the continental crust. I'm still getting a little feedback in the sound. And we suspect the same thing is true before the flood. So we're thinking that before the flood, whether there's a single continent or multiple continents, we're still trying to figure out. It's hard to discern those things through the effects of the flood. But we do believe that we had continents and oceans in the pre-flood period. The statement in Genesis chapter 7 says, in the day that the flood began, the same day, were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. This suggests to us that, in fact, the flood was initiated by an ocean catastrophe. Catastrophe that broke up something in the depths of the oceans, and in fact upon the land when the Hebrews investigated here. And something also, perhaps an effect, was this opening up of the windows of heaven. So we suggest that the day before the flood, in a sense, we still had this situation where the ocean crust was denser than the continental crust, but we had a peculiar situation in that the ocean crust was actually denser than the mantle underneath it. Now that happens to be the case today in places where the basalt of the ocean crust is cool. Where it is cool, it's actually denser than the material underneath it. We suspect that this particular situation may not have been the way the earth was created, but it came to be the situation when either the mantle was heated up due to radioactive decay or some other mechanism. We're not exactly sure how this inversion, this density inversion occurred, but it set things up for the beginning of the flood. What actually initiated the flood? We don't know. It's the punchline. Was it the actual hand of God that initiated the action, the physical action? That might be implied from 2 Peter. Or was it in fact helped out by an extraterrestrial impact? I currently have a cryptobleme research group we've started up with an astronomer and a hard rock geologist myself, and we're bringing in a physicist to model this, where we're trying to figure out, we have evidence of asteroid impact during the flood, and we want to be able to model this to determine whether or not this had an impact on the beginning of the flood. We don't know the answer to this question. We don't know what actually caused it. One of our group has suggested that things were so delicately balanced at the beginning of the flood that it may not have taken very much to initiate it. In fact, he jokingly said at one point, it was actually the slamming of the door of the ark by God that initiated the flood. Whatever did initiate the flood, it started to involve the things happening in the mantle of the earth. This is a diagram that shows some of the work of John Baumgartner. For his PhD dissertation, he developed a three-dimensional finite element analysis program, a code, computer code, to evaluate what happens in the mantle of the Earth in a three-dimensional manner. And previous to this, people had modeled the internal dynamics of the Earth in two dimensions. Computers could handle that, it was okay. You could do some of the calculations by hand. But what he did is develop a method that could be done across the entire Earth. This involves dividing the mantle of the Earth up into cubes, something in excess of 100,000 cubes at this particular stage. Now he's at a higher value now. In each one of those cubes, you solve a set of partial differential equations. Solving for I've forgotten the terms here. You're solving for making sure your conservation of energy, conservation of mass, conservation of momentum, the properties of the material are taken into consideration, and so on and so forth. You have to solve that simultaneously over all 100,000 cells. Now, this is something you can't do with a PC. At the time, he was using a Cray computer he had access to at Los Alamos. Now he has access to big computers as opposed to the Cray. He's got the big, massive parallel computers right after they're produced from MIT. He has access to them. This is still an enormous project, even for a computer. The Cray crashes in a half hour. given this. And it's able to simulate the equivalent of about 60 days of time in that half hour before it crashes. And although he's now got bigger computers, as is typical of people in this industry, he's improved the program, so every time he gets a bigger computer, he's got a better, more complicated mesh, so he still crashes the massive super parallel computers in a half hour, and so he's never really gotten past the 60-day barrier at this point. That's kind of curious. This is what he's doing. In a sense, what he's doing is this is a two-dimensional cross-section through the mantle. He's asking the question, what would happen if the crust on the surface of the Earth, represented at the top, and this is the core mantle boundary here, what happens if the crust of the Earth starts to dive into the mantle? I already said that the crust is denser than the mantle in that scenario, and in fact in the present, in places where the crust is cold. What happens to the dynamics of the mantle when that occurs? Here's a slab, a piece of crust falling into the mantle being simulated. It's not connected to the surface, this is just a free-falling slab. What happens is, as the slab moves down, it's about 5 to 8 kilometers thick, so things have to move out of the way, so it deforms the mantle rocks as it moves down, and when you do that, you increase the temperature of them. It's like if you take a ball and you deform the ball will warm up, and deformational energy will increase the temperature. In addition, along the edges of the slab, where the slab is moving down and friction along the side of the slab with the material of the mantle will also raise the temperature of the mantle around the slab. Temperature is inversely related to the fourth power, to the viscosity. In other words, as you increase the temperature of the mantle, it becomes less viscous. It becomes more runny. Well, that allows the slab to fall faster. And if it falls faster, it deforms more, increased energy from deformation, increased frictional energy, and it increases the temperature even more. The slab falls faster, and if the conditions of the mantle are right, and it appears that they are even today, then in fact the slab will accelerate up to a point that he calls runaway subduction, where it actually drops through the mantle at meters per second. Now, that has some interesting consequences for the surface of the Earth. Now, I'm going to talk about three things that are occurring simultaneously at the initiation of the flood. So, and I can't talk about three things simultaneously, so I'm going to talk about one at a time. But you have to understand that each of these three things are happening at the same time. So try to put them back together again after I deal with them individually. First of all, let's deal with the issue of subduction. This is the idea that the crust on the Earth is diving into the mantle. That's subduction. And the mechanism we've already alluded to, it's the fact that that material is more dense than the mantle, so gravity, buoyancy forces are actually going to pull it into the mantle of the Earth. Now here's a cross-section, again, a two-dimensional cross-section through the Earth, simulation by John Baumgartner. The green represents, I have to apologize for some of these things, the colors are going to change from one chart to another. In one case, green's going to mean what red means. In another, these physicists, they don't really care about the presentation. They're just trying to depict something in some way or another. Green here represents the temperature of the average temperature of that position of the mantle before the simulation begins. Variations on green indicate an increase in temperature as it goes towards the red, a decrease in temperature as it goes towards the blue. I'll come back to this picture several times. Here, you have evidence in these blue regions of the mantle cooling. What this is a subducted material, crustal material, subducting into the mantle, showing up as a cooling of the mantle because the crust is cooler than the mantle underneath. This is the evidence of the subduction. Now, one of those places that John drew on his map, a typical geophysicist, he really doesn't care about the reality of things. He just laid out, he started the whole thing with the continents together as in Pangaea, and then he just drew a line and said, I think all the subduction occurred in these areas, without ever asking a geologist if this was at all reasonable. And the geologist would have said, it's not at all reasonable. And one of the places he drew a line was in along the western coast of the United States. Now, it turns out that John may actually be right, because our investigations in the last few years have suggested that, in fact, there was a subduction zone out there in western United States, which we wouldn't have said was true if he had come to us first. So sometimes maybe the geophysicists are all right doing crazy things. Here is a reconstruction of what we believe the case was immediately, bless you, before the flood began. And again, in the area of what is now Grand Canyon in Arizona, we believe that that was a shallow sea immediately before the flood, based upon the rocks that we've been studying in the Grand Canyon area. We believe the edge of the continent was on what is now the pretty close to what is now the Arizona-California border. There was no California. California is actually a bunch of debris eroded off of the continent and dumped there during the flood. Somehow appropriate. And then we believe the ocean crust was connected to the continental crust at that location, and that we have evidence of the ocean crust breaking off of the continent, which must have been an incredible earthquake, the biggest earthquake, I would say, of all of Earth history, and that collapsed much of the continental margin. And we've been studying some rocks out in the Grand Canyon area, fragments of rocks we believe to have been produced in that process, and out in Death Valley, which is just off the edge of that slope there, where we think we have some pretty good evidence of that collapse of that margin. Here we're looking at some sediments that are dipped down at about 55, 60 degrees. Scale here from this point to this point is a mile. So this is an aerial photograph of some rocks in this region. We focus on these particular rocks here, which we believe to have been formed in just the first few seconds of the flood. We're looking at these from a different direction. This is actually, this formation right here is made up of a pile of rocks. It's basically what we just argued last week, as a matter of fact, at the Geological Society of America meeting, that this is an avalanche deposit. It's just a bunch of pieces of rocks, but some of the pieces of rocks are incredible. This one right here, this is a rock, an individual rock in that pile. It is about 100 meters thick, about 300 feet thick, and it is 3/4 of a mile in diameter, kind of a plate-shaped rock that slid, I believe, off of the continental shelf. And here's another one over here that's about the same size. There's one over here that's a little over a mile long. And there are four or five of them sitting here that are each of them about half a mile in diameter. There's another one off the side over here that's even bigger. It seems to be about a mile and a half in diameter. Huge boulders that collapsed, we believe, off of the continental margin at the breakup of the fountains of the Great Deep at the very beginning of the flood. Now, with subduction, if in fact we hit runaway subduction and the material on the surface is falling into the mantle at meters per second, if it's stuck to a continent, it's going to pull the continent along with it at meters per second. So conventional plate tectonics in geology, you learn about plate tectonics, they'll talk about continents moving at centimeters per year. Okay, that's about how fast your fingernail grows. We're talking about continents moving at meters per second. That's about as fast as you can run. So this isn't continental drift. This is continental sprint. Okay, and the continents would be moving fast enough that they would actually have to push ocean water out of their way, and there might even be something of a bow wave in front of them. And then when continents collide, after all the material between them has been subducted beneath the surface, the continents are too light. They can't go down. They can't be pulled down into the mantle. So all they do is collide. And they do so with momentum sufficient, the crumpling point, like a semi hitting a semi, to actually raise mountains. And in fact, in our model, we have sufficient velocities and thus momenta to actually explain how you can create the Himalayan mountains. If you have the entire subcontinent of India moving upwards into Asia, slamming into the south side of Asia at 10 meters per second, there is sufficient momentum to raise the Himalayan mountains. There is not sufficient momentum to do so at centimeters per year in the conventional model. So this is intriguing. So we have the action of moving continents and raising mountains. Now here is that chart I referred to before. It is a reconstruction of the Earth in the Pangaea reconstruction. Perhaps you've heard of this. North America, South America, Africa, Eurasia, Antarctica, India stuck right in here, and Australia all together in a supercontinent. Now, I have to say at this point, this is not actually the beginning of the flood. This is a state of the continents in what I believe to be about 40 days into the flood. We're currently working on trying to reconstruct the very first days of the flood. But this is what John started with just to see if his model worked. He had all the continents together, then he drew this line, said, I think subduction occurred here, just arbitrarily, you know, the way those geophysicists do. And it's on the western United States, by the way, that we subsequently found that perhaps he's not as crazy as we might originally have thought. And the question is, does his model explain the motion of continents as we know they did, in fact, occur in Earth history? Now, this is terribly confusing, but in lighter white are the outlines of the continents as they are now located. North America, South America, Africa's back here, Asia, India, Australia, Antarctica, a familiar orientation for you. The brighter white is the initial positions of the continents, Africa, South America, North America, Antarctica, Australia, India, and so on. It's a little bit confusing. This is the starting point. The question is, when he starts his model, when he has his model going underway, does it move the continents in the proper direction? This is important to know whether or not his model is reasonable. At the point this was done, no model no simulation model for plate tectonics had ever been able to move the continents in the correct direction. Okay, so no one had been successful at this. Now, here's the first, time down here. 2 times 10 to the first days, 20 days into simulation. That's not 20 days of computer time. This is all being done within a half hour of computer time. This is 20 days after the initiation of this process. We're doing everything with respect to Africa, so it's sitting there as if it's motionless. The arrows indicate the velocity or how fast the particular continent is moving. And again, temperature is indicated. The temperature of the surface of the Earth before the simulation is now depicted as yellow, not green as it was before. And variations from it will indicate the relative temperature. Red indicates things are warmer. What we're seeing at 20 days is between the continents, you're beginning to have hot material from the from underneath coming up and moving the continents aside. So the moon and the continents are beginning to move away from Africa as a relative position. South America is moving to the south and west. You say, now wait a minute, South America is up here, that's the wrong direction. Well, in fact, the geological evidence indicates that South America actually underwent a change in motion, and it's only recently that South America began going straight north. Before that, South America was significantly to the south, so this actually is the proper direction South America went according to the geological information. And then later it came up and impacted North America. North America is moving directly in the direction that it needs to go. India is starting its move to the north, Asia to the south. Australia is moving to the south and east. Antarctica is moving straight south, just exactly the way it ought to go. Now, this is extremely significant and should not be ignored. This is the only numerical simulation model for plate tectonics that moves the continents in the right direction, and that's terribly exciting. In fact, this is so exciting that these kind of diagrams have occurred in the secular literature. His diagrams have been recorded in the secular literature, and they get very excited. They'll have a caption down here. They'll say, This is the state of the continents 100 million years after the breakup began. Now, if you know about this, if you're familiar with John's work, and you know where this little thing is, time equals 20 days, you can make it out there in that diagram. It's right there on the diagram. This is not 20 million years or 100 million years. This is 20 days after the... And this doesn't work if you move the continent slowly. The whole thing grinds to a halt and it's dead. This only works if you move things at meters per second, not centimeters per year. Here is 40 days into the simulation. Continents are moving, again, in the proper directions. They've moved quite far apart now, talking about probably 100 kilometers or more in distance. Here's 60 days just before the computer crashes. Now, when I saw this, I got really excited. I was excited enough as it was, but as I said to John, I said, this is really neat. The length of the arrows indicates the relative speed of motion of the continents. So longer arrows mean the continents moving faster. The longest arrows on this diagram are right here connected to India. Now, I got super excited when I saw that because I already knew geological evidence is the fastest moving continent of all the continents was India. And his simulation not only moves India in the right direction, but it actually moves it with the right relative velocity. This was an exciting result. And so right now, creationists have the only correct model or moving continents in the proper direction and relative speed. Conventional geologists have no similar model. This is extremely exciting. Okay, at the same time that subduction is occurring, we have a second thing that's occurring at exactly the same time. This is not subsequent to it, but simultaneous with it. We have mantle-wide flow. We actually start circulating the entire mantle. As subduction is occurring here, you're taking a slab that's 5 to 8 kilometers thick along a distance of 50,000 kilometers, and you're pushing this into the mantle. Something's got to move out of the way. The entire mantle begins circulating. Now this, when he first proposed this, because of the results of his calculations, this was rejected for the most part. Couldn't possibly be. It was thought that the plate tectonics motion only occurred in the top 670 kilometers of the mantle. Because, in fact, we have current slabs that are going down into the Earth that seem, at the 670-kilometer mark, to hit a barrier. They, in fact, hit a chemical phase change in the Earth, and it appears as if there's no possibility of subduction through that barrier. But his work indicated that the plates actually broke through that barrier during this action, and actually ultimately went all the way to the core mantle boundary. And of course, as I said, this was initially rejected, couldn't possibly be true. We have evidence that, in fact, he was right. You can see that there's cool material moving all the way to the core mantle boundary. This doesn't mean that the plates have made it there yet. This only means that cooler material from higher up in the mantle has moved to a lower position in the mantle. And ultimately, though, the ocean crust before the flood would all go into the mantle, break off, and fall to the core mantle boundary and be piled up there. Now, a 5 to 8 kilometer thick piece of rock is going to take a while to melt and to fuse back into the mantle. In fact, it takes several million years. Since the flood is only a few thousand years ago, we would expect that pile of cold material to still be there. If, however, the continental slabs, the ocean slabs move at centimeters per year, then by the time the slabs got to about 3/4 of the way to the core mantle boundary, they will have completely dissolved into the mantle. So you have two different ideas on how fast the slabs moved. One which would say there should still be a pile of cold material sitting on the core mantle boundary. The second saying that there should be no such material, the slabs will have completely dissolved into the mantle. When John first proposed this in the early 80s, there was no way to test this hypothesis. However, since then, seismic tomography has come into play. What this is that humans sitting at various positions around the surface of the earth with seismometers have connected the seismometers to one central processing unit, one computer, and analyzed the seismic waves from earthquakes and detected them around the world, thousands of earthquakes every day, to determine the fine structure of the mantle, the subtle differences in velocities of sound waves as they go through the mantle will in fact tell us which parts are cooler, which parts are warmer, and so on and so forth. In the early 1990s, it began to be realized that there seemed to be a cool zone underneath the current subduction zones that seemed to go all the way to the core mantle boundary. Things were still fuzzy at that time, and they said there must be something wrong with the calculations. It couldn't possibly be that this cool zone should go all the way down. But in the course of time, by 1997, 3 years after the publication of this particular paper, it was finally concluded, the secular community finally concluded, that sure enough, there's a pile of very cold stuff on the core mantle boundary. Unexplainable in conventional geological theory. It is exactly what we would expect in the creation model. This is again something that's extremely exciting. Now it also has another nice little side benefit. I'll back up a little bit. What we're going to do here is, as we bring down cold material from higher up, we're going to cool this boundary between the mantle and the outer core. Now, the outer core is not very viscous. It's got the viscosity of water. Now, as soon as you do that, as soon as you cool one of the boundaries of that, you're going to produce a phenomenon you're all quite familiar with. If you take a pot of warm water, or hot water, and throw some ice cubes in it, you will notice, and if you don't do anything else, you will notice the water begins to circulate. As you melt the ice cubes, you produce Hadley cells of convection in the liquid. Or, if you put a pot of water on the stove and heat it up, you'll begin to see the water convect in this fashion. This is what's going to happen here. You cool the core mantle boundary, and the core, the outer core, since it's so non-viscous, will in fact begin to circulate. Now, the consequences of this are interesting, because it is in the outer core that we believe that the Earth's magnetic field is produced by electrons that are going in circles there in the core. They generate a magnetic field. The magnetic field is passing through material, propagating its way out of the Earth. And if it's moving through material that is itself moving, the moving material moves the magnetic field. And when you move a magnetic field, you create a changing electric field, which generates another changing magnetic field that counters the change in the magnetic field you started with, Lenz's law in physics. You don't have to know the details, just to know that what this does is produce effectively a counter magnetic field, a magnetic field that's going in the opposite direction as the original magnetic field. It's much weaker than that original field, but it would propagate through the Earth, and what you would detect at the surface as this began to occur is that the magnetic field of the Earth would basically turn off as perceived from the Earth's surface, and then switch and now assume a much lower magnitude, much weaker magnetic field, and be going in the opposite direction as the original one. And then, on a regular basis, every couple of weeks, the field would switch again. And switch and switch and switch and switch, we'd have reversals of the Earth's magnetic field. And the reversals would occur on the order of every other week or so. Now, this is in direct contrast to the conventional model for the Earth's magnetic field and its reversals. This theory, proposed by Russ Humphreys, suggests reversals every couple of weeks and taking only about a week or two to occur. The conventional model has a completely different kind of magnetic field, one that's also generated in the core of the Earth, but for different reasons. And it does reverse, but in their model, the reversal requires at least 1,000 years to be accomplished. So you have two different models for the Earth's magnetic field. One that says the magnetic field requires only about a week or two to reverse. The other that says it takes 1,000 years to reverse. Well, that's a big difference. Hopefully we can find a way to test between those two, and there is a way to test between those two ideas. As lava flows over the surface of the Earth, it's, of course, initially very warm. And as it's extremely warm, there are effectively little magnets inside there. The iron, magnesium minerals that are in the lava have actually magnetic properties. And they, like little compasses, they orient themselves in the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. So you have a whole bunch of little compasses telling you what the direction of the field was when the lava cooled. Now, as the lava cools from the top and the bottom, it will freeze these little puppies in that orientation so that they will remain in that orientation. But let's say before the lava cooled completely, your field reversed. It now went in the opposite direction as it was initially. The stuff that's still warm in the middle has the ability to switch around and follow the orientation of the new field. But these other guys are frozen in place. It results in a very strange situation. Where the outside of the lava flow has orientations in one direction, and the inside has the opposite orientation. Well, since we know how long it takes a lava flow to cool, we can then determine from that how long it took the reversal to occur. In fact, in 1986, when Russ Humphreys proposed his model for the reversal of the Earth's magnetic field, he said, he had predicted that you should be able to see a reversal in a basalt flow 1.5 feet thick. Now it cools in a few weeks. If it takes 1,000 years for the Earth's magnetic field to reverse, you would never pick it up in a lava flow that cools in a few weeks. So he said a prediction of his model would be that you'd see a reversal in a lava flow 1.5 feet thick. Prediction, 1986. 1988, 2 years after he made that prediction, some geologists out in the Columbia River basalts out in Oregon, Steens Mountain, Oregon, found a lava flow that showed evidence of different directions inside the lava flow from outside. They calculated that the reversal must have occurred in something less than 14 days. They tried to get the material published. These are not creationists now. Poor guys. They had no idea. They had never heard of Russ Humphreys' model and so on. They were just field geologists. They're giving the data that they see in the field, and they're trying to get this published, and no one would publish the material. Because they said, no, it takes 1,000 years to reverse the magnetic field of the Earth, therefore you're wrong. Well, to tell a field geologist that they're wrong, that their data is wrong because of some esoteric theory sitting there in some armchair waver's office doesn't make field geologists very happy. So they went back to the field again and found a second lava flow that showed exactly the same thing. They were finally able to get it published in some obscure journal in 1992, 4 years later, and finally in 1995 got it published in Science. It took 7 years to get it published in a respectable journal. And so right now, it's accepted that there is physical evidence that the Earth's magnetic field flipped in only a few weeks' time, or week or two time, but that's completely counter to the current magnetic field theory. It fits the prediction of Russ Humphreys back in 1986 with his model. It's very exciting. Consequence, by the way, just for fun, if in fact Russ Humphreys' model is correct, which this seems to indicate, he made a prediction which was in fact borne out, it has another problem. The magnetic field that he is proposing is one that degenerates over time and is consistent, in fact, with observations we've had over the last 300 years, the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. Observations that indicate that it has been decreasing to, it's got a half-life about 1,500, 2,000 years. Making a long story short here, his field requires the Earth's magnetic field can't be any more than about 10,000 years old. If it was older than 10,000 years, it would have either decayed to non-existence, or it would have been so strong in the past it would have killed life on Earth. So it requires a magnetic field less than 10,000 years old. Yet, we have evidence of a magnetic field in the oldest rocks of the Earth, conventionally dated at 4.5 billion years old. That would suggest that the oldest rocks on Earth must be less than 10,000 years old. And so here we seem to have evidence that the Earth is in fact only thousands of years old and not millions, all from this reversal evidence. A third thing that's happening at the same time as subduction and mantle-wide flow is spreading. Same exact time. Let me see, check me. 7 minutes. At the same moment that we've got subduction and spreading, mantle-wide flow, we've also got spreading. These are the areas where mantle material is coming up to replace the plates that are moving away and then down into the mantle. So the plates are moving apart from one another. Now here is a simulation of one of John's simulations of the surface of the Earth as spreading is occurring. Here you've got regions, blue is the initial color rather than green or yellow as in previous ones. And we have areas that are warmer coming up. You can barely make out continents if you're really close here. But areas between the continents are warmer as mantle material comes up as the continents move apart. These are areas of spreading. It would be these areas where you'd have hot mantle material, 1200 degrees centigrade, contacting ocean water in many cases, vaporizing that ocean water and propelling it, we believe, hyperballistically up into the upper atmosphere, where it would spread, radiate into space, and thus cool, and come down as intense global rain. We believe these are the fountains of the great deep along all the spreading centers. In the previous picture, we're talking about a fountain that is tens of thousands of miles long, and sending material into the atmosphere, 60 to 90,000 feet into the atmosphere in a huge geyser fashion. It's spreading out and then coming down as intense global rain. We believe these are the fountains of the great deep and the windows of heaven. It's interesting that when the windows of heaven are closed in Genesis chapter 8, it says the windows of heaven were closed, the fountains of the great deep were closed, and the rain was constrained. There seems to be a distinction between rain, as we would understand it, and the fountains of the great deep and the windows of heaven. And we believe that's because this material is not acting as rain. It isn't evaporating, going up into clouds and coming down as rain. It's just going up and back down again. As an incredible global rain. Spreading is quickly creating new material at the ridge, at the places where the plates are moving apart. And and this is extremely hard to explain. I'll just make really the claim rather than try to explain it. As it's being produced, the Earth's magnetic field is flipping every couple of weeks. And there's so much new material, hot material being produced at the ridge, that not all of it, just like a lava flow, not all of it can cool fast enough to preserve the magnetic field in one orientation. So you have bits and pieces here and there that are still warm when the Earth's magnetic field flips back again. So you should get this kind of mottled appearance that if you looked into the rocks of the seafloor, you'll find portions of it that are one direction, portions of it that are another direction, portions of it, and so on. And in fact, this is exactly what is seen. We have over 600 holes we've poked in the bottom of the ocean, drilled into these rocks. And in every one that I've looked at, that data is available from NOAA, it's your tax dollars, so you can access it pretty easily. That if you drill down a core, you will find one orientation of the magnetic field, and then there will be a section, few tens of inches, where it'll be in the other direction. Then it'll be tens of inches in the other, and tens of inches in the other, and so on. It's very strange. It's not explainable in the conventional model. slow movement, slow spreading should result in a uniform magnetic field orientation until you get to the time when the magnetic field switches and takes 1,000 years to switch. It only makes sense in the rapid expansion, in rapid seafloor spreading and rapid reversal. So we have an explanation for the blotchiness of the seafloor, magnetically speaking. But still haven't explained the flood. Because if all we're doing is taking ocean water, tossing it into the atmosphere and having it come back down again, there's no change in sea level. How do you explain the flood itself? Now, this is where spreading comes in, is important. The cold crust, the crust that is subducting into the mantle, is cold. It's being replaced by hot crust. The hot material occupies more volume than the cold material. In fact, the current ridges, the current spreading centers, are 1.5 kilometers higher than the cold basalt, merely because it is warmer. So we're getting rid of the old crust and we're replacing it with crust that is at least 1.5 kilometers thicker. It is thus going to raise the bottom of the ocean 1.5 kilometers or 1 mile. And so we're going to raise the sea level worldwide 1 mile. And you can add more to that because actually this material has 5% water. It's going to release some of that water as pristine water that wasn't there before. And so we might add 1 kilometer or so. So we might be talking about 1.5 miles of water being added to the surface of the earth, or sea level rising 1.5 miles. And if our mountains before the flood were 1 mile or so high and not very much higher, then you could easily cover all of the mountains of the earth. And thus we have the mechanism of the flood. Here's a simulation of that. You can't see it, but the shoreline is in purple here. Those geophysicists in their colors. And here, 40 days into the flood, we have about half of the continents covered. By 60 days in the flood, all the continents are covered with and by this mechanism alone. Let's quickly move through here. Then now that we have water over the continents, what probably happens, and we're working on this, is that the moon's gravitational pull will actually hold the waters underneath it. The Earth will spin underneath those waters. It's what we now know as tides. But when you have a global ocean, the continents that kick the tides out, that actually take the tides away from the moon whenever the Earth rotates underneath it, wouldn't be there to stop it. And so you'd actually have humongous tides, perhaps many hundreds of meters high, and the Earth moving at hundreds of miles per hour underneath it. So you now have a mode of transport of water across continents from the east to the west. And we actually have, there's one individual who hasn't published the material yet, but has over 500,000 data points here on rocks or in North America that indicates a general east to west direction for the deposition of all of the sediments in North America throughout all the period that we believe the flood occurred. So we have a consistent east to west direction, thus the creation of the debris of California in the west. And in this process, we can deposit our barrier, our fossils, invertebrates, invertebrates, our coals, our dinosaurs. We have incredible volcanism and earthquake activity during this time. It's incomprehensible, really, to imagine all that must have been happening during this period of time. Going quickly to the conclusion here, catastrophic plate tectonics, CPT, or what I like to call catastrotectonics, is, I believe, a very powerful explanatory tool. In green, we have all the kinds of evidence that plate tectonics explains. Plate tectonics is an extraordinary theory. It explains an enormous amount of data on the surface of the Earth, an extremely exciting theory of geology. But our plate tectonics, catastrophic plate tectonics, not only explains the green stuff, which is explained by conventional plate tectonics, but goes further and actually explains things in red that the conventional theory cannot explain, including the Ice Age, which I don't have time to get into. And then besides that, it explains a number of things that must be true if, in fact, the flood is correct. Several things from Scripture and in fact, several things that must be true if the earth is young. So this is extremely exciting, I think. It's got more explanatory power than conventional plate tectonics. Not that we're done. This is only the beginning, because there's a whole bunch of questions that we don't know the answers to. One of our biggest challenges right now is explaining where in the world all the heat went. There's an enormous amount of heat released in this process, and enough heat to, in fact, boil the oceans away several times over. So the question is, how did that heat get out without doing that? We've got somebody working on that with a potential answer right now, and that's exciting. But we have lots and lots of other questions. As is true of every good theory of science, it generates more questions than it seems to answer. So there's plenty of work to do for geologists and physicists for the next decades to centuries here, if they even want to continue this research. Perhaps this model is wrong. That's entirely possible. In fact, likely, given the way scientific theories are. But what it's going to definitely do is stimulate an awful lot of very interesting research and a lot of job security for scientists in the future, I hope. So, by the way, if any of you are kind of inclined in the science area, we could use your help. Thank you very much.